News headlines continue about a rare disease.
Yosemite views are as stunning as ever, but at Curry Village, visitors can't avoid the hantavirus issue.
Three deaths are now related to the virus outbreak in Yosemite. Hi, I'm Beth Ruyak. Today on Insight, we'll speak with a UC Davis expert about the risks and symptoms. Then, The Great Outdoors becomes almost somewhere, a coming-of-age book about hiking the John Muir Trail. We'll talk with author Suzanne Roberts. A unique show in Sacramento this week features the work of internationally acclaimed blind artists. One of them, Peter Eckert, shares his story and his talent. Plus, revisiting Sea of Bees. Julianne Benziger has a Sammy nomination for 2012 Artist of the Year, a good reason to listen again to a fun interview from earlier this summer. That's today on Insight. From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Beth Ruyak. It's great to be back in the studio, and thank you very much to Rick Cushman for guest hosting last week. I was out enjoying the spectacular great outdoors of Northern California, and I think especially at this time of year, every day seems breathtaking. But there are a few concerns, road construction being one of them, mosquitoes, rattlesnakes, bears, wildfires. And then there's something different this year. For the first time in a long time, we are talking about hantavirus. So we're going to begin there because hantavirus was first identified in 1993. Fairly recently, the disease is rare, but an outbreak in Yosemite National Park, as you probably know, has now caused three people to die and left at least five others sick. Dr. Stuart Cohen is joining us by phone from a convention in San Francisco. He's going to teach us more about risks and symptoms of hantavirus. He is professor of infectious diseases at UC Davis. Hello, Dr. Cohen.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Welcome to Insight. What is your level of concern with this outbreak and the unique aspect of it?
Well, you know, as you mentioned in your introduction, we have not seen very many cases of hantavirus, period, in Northern California, but certainly the last case that we saw was probably about 10 to 15 years ago, as I remember. And with that in mind, I think the first and biggest concern up front is that initial therapy and management up front is critical in whether the patient is going to survive or not. And we don't usually think about hantapulmonary syndrome just as part of what we think of routinely. And so I think that probably some of the problem comes in that people are not thinking that that's what this is, and management is different and may lead to worse outcomes.
With you saying that, I am going to add that initially the attention was focused on cabins in Yosemite's Curry Village. But now after this eighth person was sick who had been from High Sierra Camp, health officials have expanded the alerts to anybody in that area. Let's talk about from the point of contact to when symptoms are developed. What's the progression of this disease?
Yeah, so people get exposed to the virus by inhaling either urine or droppings from mice. At least in Northern California, it's mice. And the incubation period between the time that somebody is exposed and may start having symptoms can be as long as 6 weeks. Most people would say that incubation period usually is around 2 to 3 weeks. And the first symptoms may be symptoms that you would think about with flu. So muscle aches, maybe fever, headaches, maybe even nausea and vomiting as part of the syndrome. And then after that so-called prodromal period, patients rapidly progress to having shortness of breath, difficulty breathing where the oxygen in their blood goes way down. there's also a component to this syndrome that involves the heart. So heart functioning also decreases, which may lead to actual fluid containing or fluid getting out, leaking into the lung tissue itself, making the shortness of breath even worse. So if you were going to say, I may have been exposed because I was in Yosemite, if you're beyond 6 weeks out, the chances are quite remote that you're going to ultimately end up presenting with symptoms. If you're beyond 3 weeks out, the chances are still smallish, but still present between 3 and 6 weeks. And if you're in that window period where you're at the highest risk, then keeping alert for early signs should bring you to medical attention sooner than waiting until you're already can't breathe.
I'm going to translate very directly that if anyone has any doubt and was in Yosemite, they should go to a doctor and be tested because the disease can be tested for. And I'll add that Yosemite has set up a hotline, which we'll link to our website so that people can call if they have any questions. But our senior producer, Jen Picard, brought up an interesting point this morning, Dr. Cohen, and that is no employees have become infected. Does that surprise you?
Yeah. I guess it doesn't. A lot of it depends on what happens in these camp areas. So as I understand it, and I haven't been to Yosemite in several years, but I remember that when we used to go, Curry Village was Quonset huts. It was tents.
Tent cabins, right.
And they upgraded some of these tent cabins to put walls in these cabins, the so-called signature tents, and that area of space between the wall and the tent is a place where these mice can hide out and can potentially contaminate the environment. And then the way that this happens typically is that people disrupt the environment, right? You start aerosolizing the virus in
right.
the dust and in the dirt. So assuming that the employees are not digging around in the cabins, then the risk is lower, right? The risk of hantavirus infection is actually higher indoors than it is outdoors. And it's thought that maybe partially because the virus is inactivated by ultraviolet light, which it doesn't get when it's inside a cabin or even between the walls of these tent cabins. And it's the agitation of the material that gets it up to where people can breathe it in. So I guess unless the employees themselves come in and clean these cabins out agitate the dust and dirt themselves, then I don't think it's that big of a surprise that the employees haven't come down with illness.
The way you describe it makes sense, and I'm remembering that in my mind, the impression I had of the people who were most at risk through the years of this virus were exterminators or
right.
or rodent kind of workers who might be crawling under a house or might be trying to eradicate rats or something, and then they would be exposed to the airborne dust from the feces.
Right. Well, even the first couple of patients that were identified back in 93 and New Mexico around Gallup, these guys were young athletic guys who were just out digging around in the dirt. And so I think that, there's a correlation between being active and the argument is that that's why it's a male predominant disease too, is that those types of occupations and those types of associations are going to be more likely with men than they are with women, I'm not trying to be a sexist guy about it.
No, I think I understand what you mean, just
but
a relationship.
But I think that's sort of, you know what I mean? And I, and hunters have been at risk, and other people who are out and are much more likely to have exposure to the environment out in that area.
I'm talking with Dr. Stuart Cohen. He's professor of infectious diseases at UC Davis and the chief of infection control at the UC Davis Health System. So I do want to take note of catching up on the source or preventing the spread in terms of cleaning products or being able to allay any fears. What works?
Right. So the suggested strategy is if you're going into an area that's been closed up for a while, or even if you're not and you're thinking that I want to clean things out and make sure that I'm not at risk, the idea is to open the tent or open the room or open the home to air for about 30 minutes before you get in there. And then the second thing is not to start sweeping or vacuuming or doing anything that's going to generate aerosols, but rather to hose down these areas, as I say, with 10% bleach solution, right? So normal bleach, one part bleach, 10 parts water, is good for inactivating just about any microorganism and will definitely inactivate the hantavirus, and you soak these areas down and let them sit, and then you would clean things up. So if you happen to see mouse droppings or things like that, then you clean with a paper towel rather than sweeping it out and things like that after it's been treated. Use gloves, and really if you're super compulsive about it, you can buy N95 masks at any of the hardware stores, which also would prevent aerosols.
I was at a camping location in Soda Springs over the last couple days, and the proprietor, Mike Rogers, said that they had treated and washed all the cots and the mattresses and the floors with a water solution like this, not because there's any infection or ever any trace of it there, but because of fears.
Right. Well, you know, you don't want people not coming because they're worried they're going to get sick. You know, the last case that I remember was a patient who went camping up in the Tahoe region. This is 15 or so years ago, as I mentioned. And she was staying in a tent cabin up there, too, and it was chilly. And so she grabbed a blanket from the, I guess, a cabinet or wherever they were keeping them, and sort of shook out a bunch of dust, and then ended up presenting with hantapulmonary syndrome. So I think it's those kinds of things. And so if the proprietors are doing their best at making sure that they're not dust collections, that they're not these sort of unexpected sources where the organism could be aerosolized from, then I think they're making things as safe as they can possibly make it.
I think you've given us some really good practical information. I really appreciate your time. I know you stepped out of a meeting to join us, but thank you very much, Dr. Cohen.
You're certainly welcome.
Dr. Stuart Cohen, professor of infectious diseases at UC Davis. It probably bears out mentioning that we're talking about 8 cases out of 22,000 visitors to Yosemite, and the 5 people who have the virus at this point in time reportedly are recovering. There is a hotline. We've connected it to our website, and you can review this information at capradio.org/insight. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm not done being outdoors yet, so we're going to talk a little bit more about it in a little different way. Author Susanna Roberts writes about her journey on the John Muir Trail coming up next. You're listening to Insight on Capital Public Radio. I'm Beth Ruyak. A 28-day hiking adventure on the John Muir Trail brings out the best, the worst, and some truths about a person. To take on the challenges, you either tap into your strength and skills, or you have to develop them pretty quickly. And if you have a good sense of humor, it helps a lot. Suzanne Roberts lived that hiking experience with two girlfriends. She writes about it in her new book titled Almost Somewhere. She's an English teacher at Lake Tahoe Community College, and she's been named the next great travel writer by National Geographic Traveler magazine. Suzanne, welcome to Insight.
Thank you so much. It's really nice to be here.
So this is a time when you're just out of college, and some kids go right to work, some go to Europe and go backpacking. You came up with a plan for the John Muir Trail. How did that happen?
Well, Beth, it was 1993, and the nation was in a recession, much like it is right now. And finding jobs was really difficult. Many of my friends were moving back home. And my friend Erica suggested that we hike the 211-mile John Muir Trail, and I thought it was a great idea. I thought it would be a diversion from adult thinking, from plans that I wasn't prepared to make at the time. And I had always considered myself outdoorsy, but Erica was this sort of seasoned outdoors woman. She had been backpacking since she could walk, and I knew that being out there for a month alone in the wilderness would probably most likely kill me. So we invited another woman along, Dion. And Dion had never been backpacking before, never even been hiking. She was graceful in sort of a ballerina way. But she had a severe eating disorder. And we thought that hiking the John Muir Trail might cure her. I knew very little about anorexia and bulimia at the time. And it was a struggle, and I didn't realize how dangerous, really, it could have been bringing her out there.
So Eric is the one that says, girls, we can do this. Mm-hmm. And she knows in her head that she's still taking on a huge adventure.
Well, yes. We nicknamed her the Commander. So yeah. you got her character right. But we didn't tell her, or I didn't tell her, about Dion's lack of experience or her eating disorder. So I kept secrets from Erica. And so Erica would have been furious because really it could have disrupted our whole plan of hiking. And so I knew that Dion was eating disordered, but Erica didn't.
What about your own secrets, your own trepidations or thrills about this?
Well, you know, my 22-year-old self was really concerned. I think I didn't internalize the way many young women do, that only our sort of sexual selves, our body, our, you know, the way we look to men is really important. And that was something I struggled with on the trail. I struggled with fears associated with that if I'm a, you know, if I'm a body walking through the wilderness, then there's some real fears there of scary men and those kinds of things. And so I think I really explored sort of my neuroses attached to that.
That's interesting. I wasn't sure where you were going with that statement. You're talking about outside external fears. Mm-hmm. The other experience in the woods is we don't take showers. We don't do our hair. We don't do makeup. Mm-hmm. We don't even know where to go to the bathroom. So what about that part of it internally?
Well, you know, that's a great question. I had done some backpacking before this trip, and I was comfortable with all of that, but I hadn't been on a very long trip. I hadn't been on anything more than a weekend. And so there was that. And I remember about halfway through the trip, we ended up at a place that had a restroom. You know, we had hiked out to get our food. And I looked in the mirror and I realized this is the first time in my life that I went 2 weeks without looking in a mirror. And it was really freeing because through the trip, I grew a lot and I got to really appreciate myself outside of what society thought I looked like, or even outside of what I thought I looked like.
And that's what this book is the self-discovery along this gorgeous trail. And you evolved, Dion evolved, even Erica changed.
She did. That's right.
So In a little bit of a nutshell, because I don't want to give it all away, what was that little bit of movement for each of you?
Well, you know, Dion went the longest that she had ever gone without binging and purging since she was 15. For a month. And of course, coming back to the world was difficult for her. But I think that gave her the strength to know she could do it. Erica, you know, it's interesting because I've spoken with her. Actually, this book has sort of gotten us back together as friends. And And she's softened so much. She's now a mother, and she's not as sort of the commander that I knew back then. And she said, you know, I knew that that trip meant something to me, and I wasn't sure what. And that's exactly how I felt. And it took me years, really, to realize what that trip did for me as a person, as a woman. And it, I feel so grateful that my 22-year-old self decided to spend the summer in the Sierra.
Not to mention the 210 miles of just gorgeous, rugged terrain. You should give me the adjectives so that you're the one that walked it. You describe it. But from Yosemite southward, tell me about the land.
Well, we actually started our trek at Whitney Portal. And that's the opposite way.
Oh, you
way.
Went the opposite direction. Right. That's
mm-hmm.
right.
Absolutely,
mm-hmm.
yeah.
You did the hardest part first.
We did. We thought it would be great.
You're
idea
crazy.
To get, you're right. Mm-hmm. Which ended up in injuries. Ended up, we ran out of food. We ended up going over passes that still had quite a bit of snow on them. It was a really big winter.
Hey, Erica's not sounding like such a great commander at the moment.
she did the best she could.
And you survived it.
Yeah, I survived it.
Which alone is its own success story. Suzanne Roberts writes about hiking the John Muir Trail. It's a coming-of-age book titled Almost Somewhere, 28 Days on the John Muir Trail. I asked if you would read an excerpt, and I think you're ready to do that. So do we need any setup?
I don't think so. I think our previous discussion has given it setup. I'm reading from chapter 27, which is the penultimate chapter in the book. And I chose this because of your question about sort of what the trip gave me. And I think these two paragraphs encapsulate that. I hadn't been able to articulate all of the reasons I had come on this trip, but now I knew why. Maybe it's true that you can't know what you're looking for until you find it. This valley wouldn't mean as much to me if I had hiked up for the day, or even 2 days. Being out there for a month opened up something that stayed closed in my day-to-day life. It is like when the street lamps go out and the sky burns with stars, and you realize they had always been there, even if you couldn't see them. I still wasn't ready to climb into a tree in a windstorm. I may never be. But I now understand the impulse to feel the vibration of a storm, to hear the heartbeat of the world. John Muir got it right when he said, "The beauty of this place can only be felt, not explained."
You lived with this inside of you for quite a few years before you decided to write a book. When did it have to bloom?
Well, as I said, I was 22 years old. I hadn't found my voice yet, hadn't found my writer self yet. And when I came back from this trip, I had to take a couple of classes to finish my degree. And somehow I was a biology major, and somehow I had talked my advisor into allowing me to take creative writing, fiction writing, and a women in lit class rather than technical writing or science writing or the classes I was supposed to take. And in those classes, what I found was I found the craft of writing, and I found other women who were writing. Mm-hmm. And up until that point, I had read John Muir, Henry David Thoreau, Edward Abbey. I had read male nature writers who sort of gave me a lens for looking at the wilderness, but I needed my own sort of uniquely feminine view to look at the land. And so I started to realize that I wanted to be a writer. And so I went back to graduate school. I studied creative writing. I studied literature. I, you know, wrote a dissertation on ecofeminism. And all of that got me ready to write this book. But the chapter 10, which is called The Ghost of Muir Pass, actually, I wrote that right when I got back from the trip.
Mm.
It's very different. I wrote the seed of that, and I wrote that for a college assignment in women in literature. And I tell my students now, what you're writing now could turn into a book in 20 years.
Well, Suzanne, it's being received really well. Like I mentioned, you're being named the next great travel writer by National Geographic Traveler. But I was reading reviews, and one reviewer wrote that she read a number of outdoors books, and even though you say you're writing maybe with a woman's voice, she liked your book better than Bill Bryson's A Walk in the Woods, which is a huge compliment. And I think it seems that you tried to write about the relationship people have with nature, and specifically women, but people. What's your observation there?
Well, I think that the traditional constructs of nature and the way we view it have relied upon things like being the individual out in nature, conquering mountains, being out there alone. And what I realized, especially on this trip with hiking with my two girlfriends, is that what I needed was community, you know, not conquer. What I needed was a real intimacy with other people out there, but also with myself. I don't think that nature is the only path to the true self, but I do believe that it's one very real way. And it's been a way in my life for me to reconnect to the self. And I think what I really wanted to convey in this book is the idea that we all have our own relationship, and it doesn't have to be filtered through what we believe, the narrative we've been taught about how to see the land. Oh, it's scary there. Oh, that's the wilderness. But that we can create our own definitions and really redefine the way that we interact with the natural world.
It's almost 20 years. Any thoughts of the three of you going out on the trail again?
You know, it's interesting. I've thought about that. I mean, yeah. I've thought about sort of at least inviting them. I live in the Sierra now. I live in Lake Tahoe. And I thought it would be a really great reunion to just at least take a hike with the three of us together. And the three of us have not all been in the same place since 1993.
Oh, my. Mm-hmm. I'm looking for the sequel already.
Oh, my gosh. I don't know.
Well, congratulations.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for joining us and for sharing your adventure. It's nice that you made it concrete.
Oh, well, thank you. I appreciate it.
The book is titled Almost Somewhere, author Suzanne Roberts, who has been named the next great travel writer by National Geographic magazine. And you can find more information at capradio.org/insight. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Beth Ruyak. Our senior news editor, Alan Ray, is standing by. So, hello, Alan.
Well, good morning, Beth. You know, there's that old line, politics makes strange bedfellows.
Yes.
Yeah, well, big race in Southern California between a couple of longtime House Democrats. That would be Howard Berman and Brad Sherman.
Mm-hmm.
And they, because of redistricting, they have to run against each other, and only one of them is going to get to go back to Capitol Hill. Endorsements today. Want to guess?
No.
John McCain.
Really?
Lindsey Graham.
Wow.
Joe Lieberman.
This is a big battle.
That's right. That's right. That would be for Herm. That would be for Mr. Berman.
Oh.
Yeah.
How about on the other side?
No endorsements mentioned on the other side.
Okay.
At this point. But it's interesting that speaking across the aisle in a case like this.
That's good. When the story goes like that, you have a reason to come back tomorrow.
Exactly. Now, there's Hewlett-Packard planning to cut about 2,000 more jobs than it had previously announced. Meg Whitman, of whom we have heard before in another regard, tries to turn the company around. In a regulatory filing today, the computer and printer maker said it would cut 29,000 jobs by October of 2014 rather than 27,000, and it's not saying why there's that change.
Oh, in this year, too.
Yeah, not a good time. Not a good time.
All right, Alan, thanks very much.
My pleasure.
Take care. An art show in Sacramento this Thursday features the work of some nationally known blind photographers, a blind painter, and a blind mosaic artist. And when I say those words, I almost find myself pausing to think about these artists at work, to think about them creating art without the sense of sight. In studio today is photographer Pete Eckert, whose internationally acclaimed work will be shown, and the event organizer DJ Lenth is joining us too, as well as Pete's companion Bunny. The show is called Visions 2, Art by the Blind. Welcome to Insight, all of you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Pete, I want to start with you. And I'd like for you to share with us the experience of losing your eyesight. It happened as an adult, but it was over a long period of time. So can you explain?
Yes. My life's divided in half. The first half of my life, I was sighted. I went through art school, got a couple of undergraduate degrees. And I was heading off to school. I'd been accepted at Yale for an architecture degree. And I started to go blind. And it was very emotional, but I had the luxury of 10 or 12 years of diminishing sight to prepare. And so...
How do you prepare? How do you prepare for going blind?
I thought, what are my two main fears? Making money and defending myself. So I got an MBA, kind of a good Band-Aid on any fiscal problem. And I got a black belt. I'm a second-degree black belt now. And so those were good starts. It didn't solve all the problems, but it gave me a good base to start off from.
And you moved into photography, and if I understand right, that actually happened after the blindness.
Yes. I have a degree in fine arts, but in sculpture. And after I went blind, I was going through a drawer and I found my mother-in-law's old camera. And there was a setting on it for infrared. And I have a quirky sense of humor, so I thought a blind guy doing photos in a non-visible wavelength, and that just cracked me up. You know, I had to start.
So you remembered the camera?
I didn't.
You didn't?
No, my wife came home, and it was a mechanical camera, you know, 1950s Retina 2 Kodak. And so my wife found me, you know, playing with all the settings on it and everything. And once I get excited about things, I'm voracious for information. And so I basically drove her nuts, you know, trying to figure out how to use it. And eventually a camera shop that's closed now, but Camera Arts was just wonderful. Their patience with me. I'd ask literally thousands of questions to their staff.
So, Pete, take me to the smallest level about how this happens. You're holding a camera and somebody places your fingers or helps you turn a dial to know where the settings are. How do you actually understand how to make it work?
No, I think of it as there's the event of taking the photo and there's a product. The event of taking the photo has to be all me. There's no sighted people involved, so I do it all by sound and touch. I've adapted all of my equipment for Braille and for touch and for sound. And actually, one of my friends is building a talking light meter for me. Fantastic.
That's it, now because you know the equipment, but in the beginning, you have to try to figure out what to do with it.
A lot of tape recording, memorizing.
Okay.
I'd actually bring a tape recorder. That was before digital recorders. And record people. The Time Life books on photography from the 70s, I tried to use those at the library, but there was no way for me to access them. So my wife started looking for them at yard sales. And I would scan those in and read them.
And Pete, sorry, this sounds like the most basic, and I almost feel dumb asking you, but how do you know exactly where to point and how to point the camera so that you get your subject? He's moving his hands, swinging it around, and he pointed it right at me. Is it all by voice? You connect by voice?
By voice and sound. When I was losing my vision, to get through graduate school, I had to study a lot. And so I'd read for an hour and a half, and I'd stop, and I had a pellet gun and a little range set up at home. And I'd shoot for a half hour to relax my eyes, to have a difference in...
Oops, that was the mic. That's okay.
A difference in focal length to relax my eyes. And I actually shot at the top of the NRA amateur pistol competitions just because I wanted to relax my eyes.
But are you telling me that hearing the pellets, too?
No, at that time, my vision was... I had enough vision to see two letters on a... on a word at a time.
Oh, okay.
And so when I went through graduate school, I could read books two letters at a time, and I had a tape recorder to help me take notes. And those are the only adaptations I had.
I'm fascinated by how excited you were in spite of a challenge that would shut a lot of people down, Pete. And I've received a description of you as an absolute magician with a camera and that you use a fascinating technique. So I guess it's that echolocating that we're talking about right now?
Yeah, echolocating, it depends on the situation. You know, sometimes I'll use touch. Some of my photos are in different scenes, and I'll actually walk up and touch things. But I'm a married man. Sometimes it's not appropriate to touch models. And so those are done pretty much all by echolocation.
Okay, well, you opened the doorway a little bit there. I've got to walk in here and talk about one of your more famous assignments, perhaps. Playboy magazine, which back in 1970 was translated into Braille. And in spite of all the jokes, the Braille version really does just have the articles. There are no pictures. But you had an invitation from Playboy in 2010 to be part of the photo team.
Yes, Bruce Hall and I, actually, we weren't a part of a team. We each individually on our own shot one of their playmates, Hirashi.
She was Miss June 2004,
yes, exactly.
I believe.
Mm-hmm. So Bruce has a little bit of vision, and he does most of his shots underwater, and I have no vision, and so I came up with my own techniques to shoot this woman. I wanted to find a new method of doing it, so I overlaid, I did double exposures, so the shots came out much more ethereal and angelic. Than most of Playboy's work.
I'm talking with photographer Pete Eckert, who is blind, and his internationally acclaimed work will be shown at an event this Thursday at Arden Hills. Also, the organizer of the event, DJ Lenth, is with us. And funds from it will support the Sacramento chapter of the National Foundation Fighting Blindness. But DJ, we're listening to Pete talk about his art, and obviously Playboy drew he and Bruce in for the gimmick of it. But you look at the quality of the work and you look at the fundraising purpose that you use artists like this for. And so what's the balance that you found in this event?
Well, I just, for me, knowing the artist, I met Pete like 5 or 6 years ago. And, you know, they're blind artists. They're great at what they do, but they're also good people.
Mm-hmm.
I've met three of them. And Bruce from Dallas, I've talked to him on the phone. And they're just good people that want to help people and show them what they can do.
Let's talk about the artists that are showing on Thursday. So the other photographer is Bruce Hall, right, Pete, who you
yes.
just mentioned. And then the painter is John Bramblett.
From Dallas.
From Dallas. And there's a story that John felt Tony Hawk's face.
Correct.
And painted a picture that looks like a photograph. Is that one going to be on display?
That one, I'm not sure. Pete, do you know, is he bringing that one?
I'm not sure.
And then let's talk about the mosaic artist.
Yeah, that's Mary. She's a local, and she's actually the chapter president this year. And she has Usher's disease, so she's blind and deaf.
And a mosaic artist. Will you pronounce Mary's last name for it? It's spelled D-I-G-N-A-N.
Dignan.
It is like it sounds. Okay. Well, it must be quite special for you, Pete, to come together with these like-minded collaborators and do a show.
What I like best is they're all positive. I heard a thing on NPR. a guy was saying, are you a Mexican or a Mexicant to his son? Mm. And that hit home. I go, I'm an American. And I'm not American. And all these people can go. Mary is a lawyer, and she is just smart as a tack. I have an immense amount of respect for all of these people. They don't give up. They're tenacious. And on top of it, they're just having fun.
It's interesting to hear you both talk like this because people might walk into the show and just be astonished by the level of work in spite of the loss of eyesight. But you're talking more just about great people.
In life.
Yeah, you can't just sit down and cry when the problem comes up. That's a waste of a life. So, getting up and going, one foot in front of the other, that's important. And all these people can do.
And one thing I got involved is with the foundation is my son has RP, mm-hmm. and he's 22 years old, and he will eventually go blind. And my father has macular degeneration, both wet and dry. But I thought getting involved and showing the positive of these artists and people that would rub off on my son. So that's kind of why I got involved.
Pete, it's really interesting to watch you because you are so sharp. Absolutely every sound that has happened in this room, your head with the perfect angle follows, and it's really quite an experience. And Bunny, your companion, is right here aside of you. But you were telling me a little earlier you face challenges every day in attitudes about blindness. And I guess right now it's a chance to enlighten people because of what you've experienced.
Well, Bunny is, his real name's Officer Clancy. He's a big German Shepherd. And, you know, sometimes people don't want us to come in someplace. And I actually carry a copy of the law to assure that we get in. But a few times I've had to sit him down and just politely say, please call the police. Mm-hmm. And let the police call up the clear up the matter.
Well, you are calm and you are positive about your approach. And I hope people will take a little bit of time to enjoy this show. Pete and DJ and Bunny, I want to thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Pete Eckert's photography will be shown Thursday at Visions 2 Art by the Blind at Arden Hills Resort Club and Spa, an event organized by DJ Lenth. And you can find out more information at capradio.org/insight. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Coming up, there was some good news for Jules from the indie band Sea of Bees. Listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Beth Ruyak. In the Sacramento News and Review's Sammy Awards, singer-songwriter Julianne Benziger is nominated for Artist of the Year, and the voting is happening now. Her band, Sea of Bees, is also nominated in the indie category. Sea of Bees is playing Bows and Arrows next Wednesday, so it's a nice cue to revisit an interview that I did with her in June. Both Jules and her longtime producer, John Bacigalupi, were here. Her new album, Orange Farben, which is nominated for Release of the Year, by the way, had just been released, and Jules was playing a lot of shows. She was getting a lot of attention, and I asked how she thought audiences were receiving her new music.
You know, I think it's been really sincere. Like, everybody's been really great. Like, I think it's just it's an honest album. And so I think people's response is really just, I think all you can be is just sincere about it, you know. And I've been really happy with the, you know, with everything.
The album is titled Orange Farben, and my German teacher, Frau Wilmot, would be very happy that I actually knew what that meant.
That's amazing. That's great.
It's the color orange. So from the outside looking in, it seems like an explosion right now. It seems like the kind of jump that artists want to have happen in their lives and their career. Is that how it feels?
It definitely feels like an explosion of some sort. Like, I think it's just a lot of hard work, a lot of dedication, a lot of passion, you know. Everybody that I work with are all my friends or new friends that I really keep in touch with, you know, and I think those people believe in it, and I do too. So it's like, I think the only good, I think the positive always wins, you know, like it always grows more, I think.
Well, let's listen to one of your favorites from the new album. It's called Teeth.
Yeah.
She is the golden hours wide, and they took me to the ledge and said, close your eyes, and I closed my eyes, hoping you would be found. And I know I shouldn't think those thoughts, and I've gone ahead and bought those thoughts, and I'm
You're listening to Sea of Bees. The album is Orange Farben. Our studio, if you could see Jules and Amber smiling and grinning and rocking as the music is playing. So here's a quote from NPR. It's hard to imagine packing more heartache into a single record than Julianne B does on Orange Farben.
I love those guys. Those guys are cool.
Is this a ringing of your heart over and over as you perform it? Because the album's about a broken relationship and a loss.
Yeah, it definitely does come, like, I think I grow every day, and I think with this album, like, playing it over, like, in shows all the time, like, I definitely have to come back to that place, but it's like, I feel not sad, you know, anymore. I feel it's just an experience, you know, that everybody mostly goes through. And it definitely was heartache, though, when I made the album. It was really hard. And it was, it's definitely heartaching. But I look back now with kind of like growth, I think, you know, a little stronger, and, you know.
Well, you recorded one of the songs from the album for us here this morning. Mm. So we're going to take a listen right now to the song called Broke.
Okay. Okay, guys, I'm not going to count this off. So just be professional, okay? Just come in. Don't screw it up, percussions.
Hey.
Well, my heart, but your heart broke. I tried to love you, but did not know what to do. How you do what you do. I'll build you gardens that you'll never see. I'll be your king if you be my queen. I don't mind to be blind. Can someone please tell me where the ghosts all gone? Did someone hear me out? It's something to be my guide. Can someone please hear me while the screen is shut? Will I shut so loud? Shall my like you're the water on the sky. Can someone please tell me where the ghosts all gone? Did someone hear me out? Is something to be my guide? Can someone please hear me while the screen.
Sea of Bees. And John, what is that magic with Jules?
She's just a naturally very gifted musician, singer, songwriter, performer. I mean, working with her in the studio, I quickly learned that she can play almost any instrument you put in front of her, even if she's never played it before. And
oh, John.
On the new record, she plays almost every instrument, even the drums. And
okay, so Amber, Jules, invite everybody to your shows.
Please come hang out with us.
Come hang and chill out with all of our cool homies.
Thank you
yeah.
for the visit.
No,
thank you for the music.
You.
Great to have you
so
here.
Nice
yeah.
That was my interview with singer-songwriter Julianne Benziger and Amber Paget, also producer John Bacigalupi. We recorded that interview in June, but Sea of Bees is playing Bows and Arrows next Wednesday, September 19th, and the 2012 Sammy Awards are Friday, October 12th. More information at capradio.org/insight. And that's Insight for today. I'm Beth Ruyak. Insight's senior producer is Jen Picard. Our producer is James Morrison. And we'd like to say a merci beaucoup to our assistant producer of many years, Lynn Weaver, who today is beginning some new adventures. Thanks and many warm wishes, Lynn. Our associate producer is Midori Yoshimura. Our technical director is Mark Jones. And then there's you. Thank you for joining us.